Hello, Mr. Bob Dylan? Mr. Dylan, this is Helena Willamo from the Nobel Prize Committee. N-O-B-E-L? Well, that really surprises me, sir. Most people have heard of it. Anyway, you are this year's winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Isn't that exciting? Maybe it didn't sink in yet. Anyway, the ceremonies are here in Stockholm in December, and you'll get your award directly from the King of Sweden. Well, I don't know who Tom Petty is, but no, it would not be really appropriate to have him accept it for you. The ceremony is December 10th, and there is a wonderful banquet. Well, couldn't you miss your woodworking class just this one time? I don't know what a brindle joint is, but I agree. It sounds like an important thing to know. I'm sorry to hear that you lost your really warm hat, but it's October, sir. You have plenty of time to buy a new one. I'm not sure what you mean by how do I know it's October. Mr. Dylan, I'm going to hang up now, but there are some people discussing this award right now. Maybe if you listen to them, you'll understand better. And now he hopes the Peace Prize goes to Ken Bone, Colin McEnroe.
Right. We're not going to discuss Bob Dylan right now. We are going to talk about Bob Dylan. We have another thing or two to talk about first. Although, I have to say, you know, when we started the Nose, we said, well, we'll talk about culture every week, about pop culture or whatever. We won't talk so much about hard news and politics. And it's harder and harder to tell those two things apart. It's like, you know, at this point, the campaign's about Marley Matlin or something. It's just very difficult to. Anyway, we're not going to talk about the campaign, except insofar as Ken Bone is the campaign. And that is still to come. Let me tell you who's here with us. Jacques Lamarre, senior project manager at Buzz Engine. And Frank Rizzo. I like saying that. Frank Rizzo, longtime Hartford Current theater critic, now freelance writer for Variety and lots of other outlets. We are going to begin with a conversation about Steve Martin's play, Meteor Shower, which is now playing at the Long Wharf Theater. I have to say, I saw that on Saturday night, and that feels like I saw it last year because, like, just stuff just keeps happening. Things that happened a week ago are just not really – they're sort of ancient history at this point. But Meteor Shower is how will we describe Meteor Shower? Meteor Shower is the story of an intrusion, I guess, of one couple upon another. It's a play that zigzags around through a bunch of different – sort of a multiverse of possible outcomes. And – I've got two, you know, theater experts here. Why am I babbling away trying to describe this? Frank, you may have already had to try to describe Meteor Shower. How'd you do?
I did. When I went to the obvious, I described it as Virginia Woolf, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf, except in this case it's Nick and Honey who are getting turning on their hosts, George and Martha, but done in a very Steve Martin way. The play also brought in a lot of other things in my mind, too. A little bit of Jules Pfeiffer, a little bit of Will Eno, and, of course, Albee. Yeah. But it's definitely Steve Martin, and you really don't know what's going on at first. And if I can suggest to audiences going in, just ride the wave and see where it takes you. And it ended up in a very funny place for me.
Well, I think it's definitely funny. I laughed all the way through it, and then I wondered a little bit more about why I was laughing or what there actually was, whether there was a there. But Jacques, I'm assuming you found this funny as well.
I did. I went in prepared to be a little bit cranky about it, and I was actually really really had a great time. I think partially because I knew very little going in, other than that Steve Martin wrote it. And I think I had read, some comparison to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's completely unpredictable as to where it's heading, all the twists and turns. And the humor is really smart in a Steve Martin kind of way. But there's enough kind of, little bits of low humor there to amuse me. So I really enjoyed it. I would highly recommend it.
I mean, I guess the question, first of all, it's absolutely funny. And there's, I mean, we don't sit around trying to figure out what duck soup is all about. It's just funny. But I think it wants to be, it intends to be more than that. We know that Martin is, in addition to being a very funny guy and a very serious intellectual, he's worked on this play for a long time. Part of its original inspirations was supposedly Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, or however that title goes. But I mean, feeding into this is the work. It's clearly the work of a guy who reads a lot of philosophy, reads a lot of analytic literature. And yet, I don't know, Frank. I'm still not convinced
I still think there's quite a bit there. Yes, it's an absurdist comedy. Yes, it goes off the rails. And yes, I had a few inconsistency problems with it. However, that being said, I think, and I don't want to overinterpret what the show is or what the play is, but this is, you know, my take on it. And as I reread the script after I saw it, it sort of came together for me. He's talking about our inner selves, our repressed subconscious, and what happens when that subconscious is unleashed and we're confronted it. And in this play, we're confronting our own ids, more or less. And how that continues, how that enters into the chaos of the universe, and how it comes crashing down literally on us. I think that's my take on it. And even though it's a little bit inconsistent for my taste, I felt that there was clarity as much as I could put on an absurdist comedy.
It's definitely a very tight cast. I guess the cast has changed a little bit. It was supposed Craig Bierko was supposed to be in it, and
right, and he left during rehearsal. And fortunately, there was a previous production of this that Gordon Edelstein, the artistic director of Long Wharf, did at San Diego's Old Globe with a terrific actor,
Stamberg.
Josh Stamberg.
Yeah, Josh Stamberg, yeah. Terrific. And so I don't think they lost too much rehearsal time. It was a perfect fit, and he and the entire cast are, you know, just hysterically funny.
This guy Josh Stamberg is interesting. I mean, first of all, if you watch a lot of television, if you watch The Affair, he's Dominic West's character's best friend, the guy who's really rich and lends him money. But he's also, Shaw, did you find, inevitably in Woody Allen movies, people start talking like Woody Allen. And I thought this guy really, he even had facial expressions that were Steve Martin. It was as close to getting an actor who could kind of do Steve Martin without getting Steve Martin.
Yeah, no, you could definitely, there were moments where you're like, oh, this is Steve Martin and Steve Martin-esque humor. I actually thought the women were unbelievable in this show. Frank and I were talking about the woman who plays Corky. Her name's Arden Myron.
Hysterically funny.
She's a stand-up comedian, too.
Yeah.
But the woman who plays Laura, who's kind of this predatory character, is also really, really striking and funny.
Who also lurks va-va-va-voomy. Yeah.
Yes.
She's that part of that whole id idea that Frank was talking about.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, I want to maybe just expand this a little bit more to talking about Steve Martin and his work and his output. One thing that one question I posed early on and as we were emailing about this, it's the thing I was thinking about as we were driving home is, obviously, this is, I mean, it is an exploration of character, of human psyche, by a very smart person who's thought a lot about these things. On the other hand, it struck me also as an exploration of human dynamics by a person who's probably really not all that comfortable on his own and on his own personal level with human dynamics. You know, and it's the question that I have about Steve Martin. He's always going to be smart. He's always going to produce really, really pleasing works that are interesting and insightful. But I feel like he can never do an Annie Hall, you know, because the characters in Annie Hall, it's one of the times that Woody Allen lets their feet touch the earth and be real people as opposed to people speaking great cleverness and cerebrality.
Well, I think that's a fair criticism if you are looking for an Annie Hall. I don't think that's particularly Steve Martin's interest, and he wants to create characters that surround ideas. Certainly his Picasso at Le Panagil is like that. It's a bunch of very funny, very smart people interacting, sharing ideas, but also being very, very funny at the same time. The Underpants was a little bit of a throwback to just old-fashioned farce. Actually, for me, it was the least of his, even though it was very, very popular. But this again, he's talking about couples. He's talking about marriage and sex in ways that I think touch on a lot of ideas as opposed to do we really know Corky and Norm that intimately? Is it warm and fuzzy? Well, it ends in a hug, but it ends in a hug in a very Steve Martin way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I said I was a little bit...
You were prepared to be cranky.
Yeah, prepared to be cranky because, you know, I really didn't like L.A. Story, mm-hmm. the film that he wrote and starred in, mm-hmm. and Shop Girl. Mm-hmm. I wasn't crazy about Underpants. So, and I'd never seen Picasso. So this was. I was kind of prepared, and I was trying to remember whether or not he wrote Bowfinger because I really liked Bowfinger. But
I think he did.
Yeah.
You're stealing one of my endorsements. But anyway,
sorry.
Go ahead. That's okay.
So I went in, you know, not expecting to be in love with the writing and whatnot. And I really was. I mean, you know, there was maybe like one or two moments where I thought, but it, you know, overall, it kept flipping your expectations. It made you think about, who are these people? You know, are they mere representations of each other? You know, halves of each other, and it led to a really great car conversation on the ride home. You know,
and did with the car shampoo caddy?
Yes, the car shampoo caddy.
Yeah, there's a big shampoo caddy. A repeated shampoo caddy joke. By the way, Bowfinger was written by Steve Martin and directed by Frank Oz. I am told. So yeah, I mean, I'm obviously being unfair. In asking that question, Frank, because in fact, you know, one of the playwrights you mentioned is Will Eno, his Realistic Joneses, which was staged at Yale Rep, moved to Broadway, and all really of Will Eno's stuff is at the level of this. It's absurdist. It's full of non sequiturs. This particular play, this Steve Martin play, Meteor Shower, also explores with kind of the notion of a multiverse. Or the lowbrow version would be sort of Gwyneth Paltrow sliding doors, you know, like what happens if this happens? What happens if this, you know, what happens if they forget to bring the wine? Well, everything's different as a result of that. It's doing all of those things. And nobody ever says to Will Eno, well, when are you going to write Long Day's Journey into Night? I mean, he's a guy who's really always sort of experimenting in a very absurd and fascinating way with language, with dialogue, with non sequiturs. I think the thing about Steve Martin is we've seen so many different versions of Steve Martin. I mean, he's in some, you know, Parenthood, you know, all these movies about weddings and stuff that are almost kind of mawkishly personal.
Well, take Roxanne. He wrote Roxanne, and that was the most tenderest, his take on Cyrano de Bergerac. That was lovely. That was heartfelt. It was still Steve Martin. And maybe there's a yearning to, you know, tap into the more romantic side, the more sentimental side.
But isn't that a perfect metaphor for Steve Martin too? The idea of Cyrano, the idea that – I mean, because I do feel like there's a way in which he would really have trouble putting his heart on the table, putting his psyche on the line in a really, you know, unguarded way.
I think that's fair.
But on the other hand, he does show us. I mean, okay,
he do that kind of in Shop Girl too, though.
Yeah,
you know, I think one of the things that's fascinating about him is that he's so completely multifaceted. You know, mm-hmm. there's the musician part of him. He just had a show on Broadway, a musical on Broadway. He's got these plays. He's writing films. You know, he started out doing things like The Jerk mm-hmm. and King Tut and stand up and. And so, I mean, to look at the trajectory of his career, you know, you could look a bit at Woody Allen and say he, you know, he started in stand-up. He plays clarinet instead of banjo. And, you know, but the thing is, it seems like Steve Martin is kind of all in for whatever he's going after.
Well, now that you mentioned it, Colin, I think there is this tension between putting it all out there and not the head versus the heart. And I think this play sort of touches on that a little, that repressed part of you and the part that you think is the right thing and the more conventional thing to do. And I think that tension is part of the humor.
And I think Jacques's right. This is a guy whose interest, whose enthusiasms, and whose complicity with different styles, it really spans. He's got a just tremendous reach. This is a guy who could write a Picasso, Le Pan, a Gilles-type play, and at the same time have participated very enthusiastically. People forget this. Very enthusiastically in the Gong Show. that makes Jacques happy. No, but during the days of the Gong Show, he was one of the panelists a lot of the time because a lot of what the Gong Show was fed into his idea. He had that Dadaist approach to humor that he was going to really purvey. And it was perfect for him. And he did other stuff, like he would sneak himself in as a vampire playing the banjo upside down from the ceiling, and eventually Chuck Barris would go, it's you again, isn't it, Steve? You know, people don't think of Steve Martin as somebody who would want to go on the Gong Show, but I mean, he kind of got that too.
Well, there's a bit of Dada, or I don't know, it's certainly extreme absurdism in Media Shower, especially in the second act. We won't give too much away other than...
it's hard to spoil this anyway.
Right, I'm resisting it.
It's interesting. I didn't want to read any reviews before I saw it, and I knowing that we were going to be talking about it, I went on and read the reviews for the Longmore production. I don't know if there were any rewrites between San Diego and here, but
I think there are. Yeah,
the LA Times hated it, hated it, and you know they were basically saying like you know
it's mean.
Mean and saying, you know, basically like, well, he's a celebrity, so he gets a spot on the stage as opposed to another deserving artist. But I felt like the work was deserving.
Yeah.
I think any artistic director who had been handed this play, you know, I mean, certainly it does not hurt to have Steve Martin's name attached to it. But it's actually, I think... reflects him but stands independent of his other work.
And also how hard it – you know, this is what I sort of lack, what I yearn for in new plays, comedies. I think people are afraid to write comedies, new comedies.
I'm not sure if they're afraid to write them as a person who writes comedies.
Present company excluded,
no, but I think part of it is theaters are afraid to program them.
Yeah. And this is really funny too. It's a – Jacques knows how – hard it is to make people laugh for, you know, however long this is, 90 minutes, 2 hours of running time.
90 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, and you're just laughing all the time, you know, and which is a wonderful experience to have, but it's not the easiest thing to do.
When you write a bad drama, you can't really prove that it's bad, but when you write a bad comedy, you really can have evidence in your back
pocket. It's the Seinfeld rule, yeah. All right, we're going to take a break. I think we all we recommend that people go see this, right?
Highly.
Yeah.
Yes, but I expect – you think he's going to win the Nobel Prize?
Well, see, there'll be people saying, well, there would be more deserving people.
Nice and that, segue,
yeah,
Frank.
Yeah, it does set up – it does very well set up our next bit of conversation. We're going to add one more voice to this conversation and talk about Bob Dylan and his Nobel Prize. We're also going to be talking about Ken Bone. He's probably not going to win a Nobel Prize, but who knows? He has very deep thoughts floating through his brain. The things that go through Steve Martin's brain are very deep and philosophical. I read the book Born Standing Up. Well, she's got jet pilot eyes from her hips on down. Bombardiers are trying to force her out of town. She's 5'9" and she carries a monkey wrench. She weighs more by the foot than she does by the inch. She got all the downtown boys all at her command. But you got to watch her closely, 'cause she ain't no woman, she's a man. And that is not the introductory music for Rebecca Castellani, although she is joining us here for this conversation about Bob Dylan. She's a scholar of modern literature, including, it turns out, the modern literature of Nobel laureate Bob Dylan. Still in the studio with me also, Jacques Lamar, senior project manager at Buzz Engine and playwright, of course, and Frank Rizzo, a former longtime Hartford Theater critic, now freelance writer for Variety and other places. We are going to talk about the news that came out yesterday. Bob Dylan is getting the Nobel Prize for Literature. Rebecca, many people stood up and applauded. Maybe we should talk about standing up and applauding first, and then we'll talk about the ways in which perhaps some people had other opinions. But I'm assuming, since you devoted some of your scholarship to this, that you think Bob Dylan is literature and good literature at that. Great literature.
I mean, at first it is the ultimate defense of my thesis, which I wrote on T.S. Eliot and Bob Dylan, so I was psyched about that. But also, I mean, it is in my mind, in my humble opinion, very well deserved. I think the debate that's come up in light of his award about what literature means today, how literature evolves. I think a lot of people think literature is simply novels. Just the debate over whether poetry is considered literature made me laugh, because I think a lot of people have some problems with what literature actually means. But Bob Dylan's inclusion in, you know, a list that includes Hemingway and, you know, great American writers, I think is very well deserved. I think it's wonderful that the rest of the world recognizes Dylan for what he is, which is, in my opinion, so much more than a musician.
Mm-hmm. Frank and I are both former rock critics. Frank was a much better rock critic than I was. We probably were at Bob Dylan concerts together because we didn't always work for the same newspaper. So I don't know. I'll let you say whatever you want about this. I don't know. I'm not sure I know exactly what your relationship to Bob Dylan would be at this point.
Just as a fan, and I saw him a few times in concert when he came through Connecticut, but I agree with Rebecca and love how the Nobel Academy has rethought and expanded their vision of what contemporary and literature is. Last year, they expanded it by giving it to Svetlana Alexievich, who's a journalist. And this year, they're embracing Bob Dylan. The only downside on it is now people like Snoop Dogg is on the phone to his publicist saying, I want one too. But other than that, I think this is a terrific recognition for a body of work.
Exactly.
Snoop Dogg also announced that he wants to get high with Ken Bone. That's true, actually. That happened this week. So, and one of the things that I thought, Jacques, was, well, like, what was Bob Dylan anyway when he arrived on the scene? And to me, he was a guy who essentially fused certain kinds of elements of musical Americana, both the folk traditions embodied by Woody Guthrie and the blues traditions, with poetry. That's like who he was from the day. Not for nothing is he named Bob Dylan instead of Bob Zimmerman. He kind of announced himself that way, that I am going to write poetry, and I just happen to be also planning to sing it with a guitar.
Well, I listened to the Carpenters, so this might be better punted off to Rebecca. I'll say that the news of Bob Dylan getting the Nobel Prize was really an interesting surprise, and I'm sure it gave Joni Mitchell her second aneurysm.
That's right. They're not getting along.
She said he's a plagiarist.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they've been feuding for the last 6 years.
Yeah.
So let's do the naysayers. I mean, there's sort of, Rebecca, two kinds of naysayers. One of them saying this isn't good enough literature. That's one argument.
Right.
And then the other argument is he doesn't need this. Even Murakami or somebody like that could benefit more from it. But also, one of the things that it's done is the Nobel Prize has done is just to call attention to various kinds of world literature, or various people who are very big in smaller circles but aren't all that well known. I don't know. Should we tackle the it's not good enough literature first?
Oh, I mean, I can go on all day about that. I think to begin to say what surprised me so much in the naysayers was a real defense of highbrow literature in the very traditional sense of what we understand literature to be, and, you know, that world needs more exposure, and by giving it to Bob Dylan, who's already received, you know, an Oscar and Grammys galore, for that exact reason that it's not necessary. But I think that if you're thinking of it from Bob Dylan's personal necessity, of course it's not necessary. I'm sure, as the opening suggested, he doesn't care at all. But what is necessary is the fact that we're expanding our definition of this to include someone who, in my opinion, produces very good poetry, very sound poetry, poetry that is informed by a lengthy tradition. You can go through his songs and analyze them with a pen and pencil, just like you can a poem. And believe me, when I wrote on Dylan for a full year, after you have to listen to him for 6 months, you get to a point where you buy a book of the lyrics and you read it like poetry.
Well, not everything is poetry. And certainly over his course of his long career, he's really come up with some clinkers as well.
Oh, of course.
But so does any writer. And yes, there's wonderful poetry in his writing, but I think also because we can come up with fragments of his lyrics that are part of our makeup right now.
Oh, of course.
But I think it's also mixed with the music. It's also mixed with his voice. It's also mixed that it's all coming from, you know, the same place. I think there's this togetherness of his music, his voice, his personality, and certainly his craft as a poet and lyricist.
I mean, Bob Dylan is at his peak when there is an amalgam of all this stuff brought together, and he is a puzzle in the sense that the lyrics or the chord progressions that are underlying popular songs harken back to songs in their tradition. So he is like T.S. Eliot in that respect, that the more you dig, the more you discover, the more your reading or listening experience is enhanced. However, to the argument that at his best, reading a Dylan, like reading Desolation Row, actually, in my personal opinion, is better read than it is listened to.
And, I mean, the other argument here is that, and it has been offered up in the last 24 hours, Jacques, I say this to you because you are a playwright, and playwrights win Pulitzers with great frequency. It can be argued that Tom Stoppard, he hasn't won a Nobel Prize quite frequently, and it can be argued, although Tom Stoppard hasn't won a Nobel Prize, but that you can read Tom Stoppard, but mostly, you know, Eugene O'Neill.
I can't even watch Tom Stoppard.
Okay, let's pick somebody else. Eugene O'Neill's work is spoken by other people.
Yes.
So, you know, why would that militate against somebody like Bob Dylan?
Well, I mean, the thing is, his music can be performed by other people and interpreted by other people. And
it sounds better by and large.
I mean, I love Sinead O'Connor's version of I Believe in You. It's heartbreaking. But, you know, it when I heard this, I was thinking like, oh, that's a really interesting choice because lyric writing is an incredible art. I mean, you can sit there and say, well, it's poetry, so therefore it's literature. But, you know, like I look at the work of Stephen Sondheim and say, you know, he's an amazing lyricist. Like that type of writing.
Frank would give that Nobel out tomorrow.
Well, it's a long overdue.
Yeah. I mean, and then I was thinking, like, all right, who else could you see getting this? You know, would a Bruce Springsteen get this type of honor?
Wait a few years.
Yeah. Well, I think the door is open now.
Yeah.
To me, Springsteen's early work was kind of made possible by Bob Dylan, but I feel as though Springsteen's moved into another thing. I don't think he – but let me just – first of all, we've gone a long time without actually hearing the voice of Bob Dylan. I just plucked out one of my little recherche favorites. It's actually kind of from a period of Dylan that people don't like very much. This is a little bit of a song called The Groom Still Waiting at the Altar.
Put your hand on my head, baby. Do I have a temperature? I see people who're supposed to know better standing around like furniture. There's a wall between you. What you want, you got to leave it. Tonight you got the power to take it. Tomorrow you won't have the power to keep it. West of the Jordan, east of America, Gibraltar. I see the turn of the page, heaven rising on a new age.
So one thing that I did, I had some college friends who were complaining or making fun of the idea of giving Dylan a Nobel Prize, and I sent them this Dylan lyric. It was written in marble and golden letters. Here a great man lived and worked and died. He laid the gravel for these paths personally. This bench, do not touch, he chiseled by himself out of stone. And careful, three steps, we're going inside. Except that it's not – it sounds like a Dylan lyric. It's by Wisława Szymborska, who does have a Nobel Prize for poetry. And I could do the same thing with the work of Seamus Heaney or Tomas Tranströmer. I'm saying that right. Swedish poet, hometown boy, who got the Nobel Prize a few years. You could take any poet's work and read it kind of a little Dylan-y and persuade somebody that it's a Dylan lyric. Because, in fact, I think he does – have something of the heart of a poet, maybe even more so than, say, a Springsteen.
He's
does.
Schooled in the poets, too. I mean, don't let him fool you with whatever he says. If you read Chronicles, he talks a lot about reading, and he was wide read. Everyone that speaks to him says he was one of the best read people. He tutored himself in the greats. So I do think that where he's coming from is very different from someone like Springsteen. Dylan is coming at it from a very, very literary tradition. And emphasis on the word tradition. I mean, a lot of the stuff that he is talking about is Shakespeare, the Bible. I mean, he likes his oldies.
Shakespeare, he's in the alley with his pointed shoes and his bells.
I wonder if the winning of the Nobel Prize has anything to do with on November 1st, Simon & Schuster is coming out with the complete lyrics of Bob Dylan.
Well, I watched something this morning.
I'm just throwing it out there. Yeah.
Margaret Atwood thinks that Dylan winning the Nobel Prize is to do with our presidential election. She thinks it's a deep conspiracy. And I love Margaret Atwood. I was very confused by this, but...
Well, no, I don't really see that. I mean, clearly when they gave Obama the Nobel Peace Prize based on not too much at that point, that was a rebuke of the Bush administration.
Yeah.
I don't think they do that with the Nobel Prize for Literature, and I'm not sure.
I don't either, but Margaret Atwood does.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so that brings up the other question. I mean, you can look around and see all kinds of worthy people, people who have toiled in the vineyards of literature unaccompanied by electric guitars, and say, well, you know, boy, and they still, Philip Roth still doesn't have, or I don't know, you could pick somebody who doesn't have a Nobel Prize and say,
Stephen Sondheim.
Okay, well, that would be breaking new ground. This is like, but you know, old style, old school people who work in the fields of literature, or in fact, you know, less sung poets, and there's some Croatian poet who was shortlisted, and there's the Kenyan guy whose name I can't pronounce, and I won't even try. And so that's the other argument. Bob Dylan got it, so somebody else didn't.
Well, you know, I have to admit that I was not aware that it was necessarily a lifetime achievement thing, because the science awards for a very specific thing, and
well, they go back way, you know, sometimes they go back decades.
Yeah, and so so I've never really paid that close of attention to, you know, what the criteria was for this. Mm. So
yeah, sometimes it's
all
like,
I know is I've not received one or a Connecticut Critics Circle Award.
Yeah, MacArthur Grant is the only one that really matters. Well, I mean, I think, Rebecca, the other thing that I thought about this, and I was watching on Twitter and there were people, you know, who were very smart talking about all this and kind of tisking about it a little bit. But the other thing that I always notice is people, if you ask people if they like poetry, they often will say no. Do you want to go to a poetry reading? No. Would you like to go buy a volume of poetry? No, thank you. So, but when you tell them, well, so, but you like Bob Dylan, right? And that is poetry. In some ways, maybe you are opening the door so that somebody goes and finds, you know, Wislawa Szymborska or somebody
Absolutely.
Else who won a Nobel Prize.
I mean, at the end of the day, the Nobel Prize in Literature is the appreciation of it is reserved to highly educated people that recognize these people and have read them. And Bob Dylan from day one has appealed as the everyman. I mean, he is as integral to Americana and our fabric of American culture as anyone. Everyone knows who Bob Dylan's name is, whether they've heard a song by his or not. So I do think he made poetry and tough poetry, poetry that wasn't, you know, typical romantic poetry. It was poetry that challenged and tugged at you. And for him to maraud that under all these different guises he assumed, the folk guys, the rock guys, the evangelical Christian guys, all of these different facets of Dylan exposed a different subset of American culture to his poetry. And I think that that's a lot more than other, you know, poets proper can say.
and probably reached a much wider audience than a poet ever would.
Of course.
All right. So let's go out of this conversation anyway with a little bit of Bob Dylan, one last little bit. Not a very good segue for a conversation about Ken Bone. This is we'll end with Ballad of a Thin Man.
You raise up your head and you ask, is this where it is? Then somebody points to you and says, it's his. And you say, what's mine? And somebody else says, well, what is? And you say, oh my God, am I here all alone? But something is happening and you don't know what it is. Do you?
Maybe that's the precursor to The Realistic Joneses by Will Eno. Maybe we're just talking about the same subject over and over again on this show, in which case we'll go from Jones to Bone, and we will talk about Ken Bone. Maybe before we say a word, we should hear the moment, the dark night of the soul, when suddenly this, as Chelsea Handler calls him, little cherry tomato, stood up and said the following.
We have one more question from Ken Bone about energy policy. Ken?
What steps will your energy policy take to meet our energy needs while at the same time remaining environmentally friendly and minimizing job loss for fossil power plant workers?
Mr. Trump, 2 minutes.
Absolutely. I think it's such a great question.
All right. So it's now possible that Trump will be gone and Ken Bone will still be here. And one of them feels much more temporary than the other. And it's not the one we probably should have thought. So there's some way, Frank Rizzo, in which America kind of rose up to embrace this guy. He's, you know, as Jacques said in one of his emails, having his 15 minutes of fame, except it might even be bigger than 15 minutes. He's not only been on Jimmy Kimmel, he's going to be Jimmy Kimmel's special correspondent in Vegas on Wednesday for the final debate.
Hearing this, it's like, oh, that's right. That was the question he asked. For the life of me, I couldn't remember the question that he asked. But I think this is part of our desperate need and hunger for some sense of normalcy. And because there's nothing more normal looking than a Ken Bone, the way he looks, the way he talked, I think we just embraced that moment as opposed to why wasn't the Muslim woman embraced? Why didn't she become the takeaway figure from that debate? But I think there was this hunger for we just want to be normal again, and we'll take the guy who reminds us of our high school guidance teacher.
I know that, Rebecca, you were feeling, as many people were, kind of a little bit scared, alienated, and depressed. And then Ken came along.
And then Ken came along. Yeah, no, I was having like a physical reaction to this one. Like I was pacing. It just felt so – that was just such a scummy debate on so many levels. And when Ken Bone rose seemingly from the mists like Aphrodite and answered his question, I stood right up and I said, Ken Bone, which I'm sure was echoed throughout houses across the country. So, yeah, to see someone who is, you know, for Dylan's word, an everyman up against these ridiculous media saturated figures is very refreshing. It was a breath of fresh air. My poor partner works in the solar field energy consultant business and was very sad that Ken Bone was Ken Bone because it completely took away from the question and no one really remembered anything about the subsequent debate on clean energy. They just remembered Ken Bone.
Although it did seem, Jacques, as though the sweater itself might be a source of renewable energy. It just glowed. and Jacques is wearing kind of a zip-up sweater today.
Yeah,
and
it's not bone-worthy, as I would say.
So although Jacques has been seen recently on Facebook rocking some serious kind of suit. But let's hear Ken Bone talking about the sweater, because there's no Ken Bone without the sweater, right?
I had a really nice olive suit that I love a great deal, and my mother would have been very proud to see me wearing on television. But apparently I've gained about 30 pounds, and when I went to get in my car the morning of the debate, I split the seat of my pants all the way open. So the red sweater is plan B. I'm glad it worked out.
There is something about, I don't know, is there anything more to be said about the sweater, or just maybe his own, like he is kind of standing in for us? This is the kind of thing that
I actually really like the sweater. I would wear that sweater. You know, I was at a wedding on the night of the debate, so I did not see the debate. And so I got home and went onto Facebook, and there was Ken Bone on all these people's feeds. And I was like, I couldn't understand.
Took a little contextualizing, didn't it?
Yeah. And then when I found out we were going to be discussing it, I had to like bone up.
Bone up!
You see what you did there.
I did. And, you know, and I watched his interview on Jimmy Kimmel. And, you know, there was some discussion in the emails as to whether or not, you know, he's someone that we're making fun of, or if he's someone that, you know, is in on the joke, or is he a joke at all? And, And the thing is, you know, watching him on Jimmy Kimmel, he was really, you know, relaxed and having fun. I think he, you know, his Twitter account has gone from like 17 followers to 238,000, and he's calling it the Bone Zone now, and you can buy a Ken Bone t-shirt. So I think he's having fun with it.
Yeah, so Frank, I think we've seen over the course of time anti-celebrities like him before. William Hung pops to mind.
Joe the Plumber.
Joe the Plumber, people like that. And rarely has somebody seemed so aware of what it meant to be an anti-celebrity or whatever it is we're going to call Ken Bone. It's kind of like he really gets the exact sweet spot he's sitting in right now.
He seemed to like have a publicist and a media plan like the next morning. So I think there is this awareness of how you can be transformed and how you can become a fleeting icon overnight, and he seemed to be very adept at doing it. What's nice about it is that he has a sort of sweet, dorky personality, so you don't find him particularly offensive. He was also on that midnight show on Comedy Central, the quiz show last night, and he was... It was very charming, wearing his red sweater again. That makes him look like a blood clot, and he went with it. It was, and he had a very sweet nature, and but he's not without awareness.
So, Rebecca, once upon a time before you were born, this kind of thing. You could sort of identify somebody who wasn't ever really meant to be a celebrity, but somehow had become one. I feel as though the environment that you've come of age in with reality television kind of makes this a little bit more de rigueur. It doesn't jump out as much. There are all kinds of people who are famous who don't really seem to have any of the skills, qualification, charisma, or looks that we would associate with being famous.
Oh,
so
yeah.
For Ken Bone to even stand out in this way is kind of an accomplishment.
It's an accomplishment, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, the second he appeared on stage, he was the most memeable thing to probably come out of this election. I mean, he is a living, breathing human embodiment of the idea of a meme. And, you know, we're ready for that. We love it. We jump on it. It's, you know, this is this whole conversation about memes, how interesting it is that they just seem to spring out of the internet's desire for them. And, you know, this is what he – and at least he's self-aware. I mean, it would be very sad if he was not as aware and tapped into this.
He's self-aware but not aware because he's an undecided voter.
Right.
So how aware can you possibly be if you're a undecided voter?
And some unsavory things about Ken Bone have come to light in wake of his celebrity. So –
We actually, if you'd like to hear Ken Bone, not the unsavory things, but Ken Bone talking about being undecided, here's a little bit of him on Jimmy Kimmel.
This is an unusual political cycle. It's been so negative, and I try to really base most of my decisions on positive things, and neither of them have given me many. So Donald Trump maybe is more in line with my economic interests because I work in coal electricity.
I see.
But I would really hate for anyone's rights to be taken back. We've fought so hard to get marriage equality and rights expanded to more Americans, and I couldn't, it'd be unconscionable for me to see those taken away by a Supreme Court justice appointed by Donald Trump.
I am.
Oh, Jacques, maybe he's not so undecided.
Yeah. I'm team bound. You know, I think it is that this election has been so relentlessly ugly that just having this kind of cheery little
Ken Bone
elf
cheery tomato
pop up, yeah.
It sounds like a song, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Stephen Colbert already wrote one. So we're going to pause here. I just quickly would say that, one thing that I've been thinking about a little bit in my particularly teaching a class on this is, you know, in 2008 we had all kinds of odd things going on and some negative things being said. We had the emergence of Sarah Palin, which some people maybe found a little bit frightening. But there was also that Hopi Changey thing. Any cycle that I've been through so far has always had some element of positivism in it. And I feel like we're just so desperate for something this time. There just isn't any Hopi Changey thing
throw
at
us
all.
A bone.
It's like we Hopi we make it through this somehow. So yeah, Ken Bone. The other quick thing that I would say is that I think Ken Bone is the kind of person that Letterman used to discover. You know, Letterman had this real fondness for, like, the guys who work in the convenience store. You know, it was always that.
Sarah Jewel and Muji Burr. Was that their names?
I think so. That's very good, though.
Larry Bud Melman.
So he's very much kind of the rear guard of the Letterman revolution. All right. We're going to take a break, so we'll have time to endorse some things when we come back.
I've got a question for you. about energy sustainability, stopping the jobs from going overseas.
Balls.
Ken Bone is reason enough for one more Sharknado movie. Today's show is produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern was Squeaky Fisher, Rusty's sister. The part of Bill Curry was played by Roy Orbison. Hear all of our past shows at WNPR.org/Colin. And on Monday's show, we'll catch up on the latest campaign news, which will probably be something involving Lisa Gibbons and, I don't know, Dee Snider? I'm just spitballing here. And now, back to Colin.
It really is almost impossible to figure. One thing that I figured about looking at the list of people who've been on The Celebrity Apprentice, I realized Ken Bone is the kind of person who would wind up on Celebrity Apprentice eventually, and he's sort of that level of celebrity. All right, time for some recommendations. What have you got for us, Jacques Lamar?
I want to recommend, and I think Frank may echo this, this year is the first year that I've actually subscribed to local theaters. And so I subscribed to Hartford Stage and subscribed to TheaterWorks. Before, I would just freeload. And as a person who worked in theater and whatnot. But I think going along for the whole artistic ride of a season is really sort of a worthwhile experience. And the theaters, of course, can use your support. That's not limited just to those two theaters. There's CRT up at UConn, Yale Rep, Long Wharf, Playhouse on Park. But I think by giving yourself 5 or 6 nights going on an artistic journey is really a worthwhile thing.
We subscribed last year to New York Theater Workshop for the same reason, and you make sure you go into New York to see all those plays too. So, yeah, you see plays that you wouldn't get to otherwise. Rebecca, what have you got for us?
So in the Dylan thing, if anyone is interested in learning out more about Dylan's literary legitimacy, the number one scholar, my personal Dylan scholar hero is Christopher Ricks. He wrote a fantastic book called Dylan's Visions of Sin. It's very informative but very, very readable. It's not something you need any sort of degree to get through. It's very easy to read and very, very interesting. And to pair that, I really recommend the Rolling Stone compiled all of Dylan's interviews in text form. Bob Dylan, The Essential Interviews, edited by Jonathan Cott. And if you are a Dylan fan, you really you smile reading his different phases and guises that he puts on during the different interviews. It's a good read, so I recommend those too.
And the Simon & Schuster book on November 1st.
That's right. That's right.
And Frank Rizzo, what have you got for us?
I've been telling everyone I know to check out the Great British Baking Show.
It's my favorite.
I am
obsessed.
Obsessed by this.
Yeah. What's it on?
It's on PBS, but it originated with the BBC Two, then it went to BBC One, and now...
It's the greatest thing you can do for yourself.
Absolutely, especially in an election campaign like what we're having. It's my Valium. Mm-hmm. It makes me...
And the innuendos. I mean, it's got everything. And
do you actually bake? Do you bake?
No. Oh, no.
No, I
that's not the point,
I don't
Colin.
That's what I was really wondering.
What's the format of the show? Is it a competition?
It's delightful.
It's set in a tent like in Downton Abbey's backyard with the most lovely twee lady, Mary Berry. And the name itself sounds like a tart. But there's a raging controversy now because it's gone commercial, but I don't want to take up too much more time. But you can
do a whole show on it.
We might have to do the nose. We may have to do a segment on the nose about this.
Great, baking show.
Piqued my interest. All right, very quickly, I would recommend Lost on the River, the new Basement Tapes. This is Bob Dylan's poetry set to other people's music. This is lyrics that were discovered. T-Bone Burnett locked Elvis Costello, Rhiannon Gibbons, Taylor Goldsmith from Dawes, Jim James from My Morning Jacket, and Marcus Mumford in a building and had them write songs to these lyrics. And so you actually now see the poetry of Bob Dylan sort of showcased or dropped against music written by other people. It's really interesting. The documentary that goes with it is terrific, too. You get to see a lot about the anxiety of creation going on among these very esteemed musicians. So Lost in the River, the new Basement Tapes. I think we might go out with a song from there. Bowfinger, as Jacques said, I think maybe the most neglected Steve Martin masterpiece. It's a Steve Martin masterpiece and an Eddie Murphy masterpiece about an unscrupulous filmmaker who's trying to make his money back basically by, well, it's two with the the concept is too complicated to explain. It's just really funny to see it. And then also, as far as funny goes, just Google Chelsea Handler, Ken Bone, and see Chelsea Handler's profession of love and desire for Kenneth Bone. I won't ruin any of it for you. Thanks very much to Jacques Lamar and to Rebecca Castellani and to Frank Rizzo. Okay, actually, we're going out with Grace and Hugh, and we'll be back on Monday with a scramble.
Waterberry, Oliveberry, Woodberry, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah.
On the radio, she on the radio.
On the radio, baby. You and me talking, laughing down.
If Ken Bone and I got married, my name would be Kion Bone. I'll just leave that right there.